court will take a short break before hearing the next argument.
You can start over here. Oh, okay. Is this the? Gizmo.
Stand, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Howard Lindsay, and I represent Bentonite. This case concerns an effort by 42 of 69 of the company's employees to decertify their union. Disaffection from the union was evident weeks and months before any of the alleged conduct occurred in the week of July 9, 2007. The board's decision and the administrative law judge's decision virtually ignored the pre-existing disaffection. Based on the known disaffection of a number of individuals, the company met with those persons individually and provided them information concerning the process of decertification. They answered employees' questions, provided the information, And during the course of that, provided a comparison chart of which compared benefits in existence under the collective bargaining agreement with benefits which existed at that same facility for non-represented personnel. They verified the company in meeting with those individuals, verified that the individuals still maintained a desire to be rid of the union, and following their questions, the company responded. Those employees were subsequently joined by additional two more volunteers who also circulated petitions. All of the petitions eventually reached the company, and the company management withdrew recognition on July the 13th after it verified that a majority of its employees no longer wished to be represented by the union. Union filed charges, a trial was held, and the ALJ in the case found 8A1 and 8A5 violations. The administrative law judge's decision was anchored by two important factors. One, his disregard of the pre-existing disaffection demonstrated by those individual employees. There's no question that that disaffection existed not only weeks but months, and in some cases almost a year before, that it had been currently repeated. It was.
You've described the management's response to this as a response to this disaffection. The ALJ and the board have found it differently, right? They see a more proactive role than instigation of the certification. What's the standard? How are we supposed to resolve that difference of what took place here?
Well, I think, Your Honor,
it's very deferential, right? It's substantial evidence.
Well, you have to have substantial record on the board has to adduce substantial record on the whole. I think they entirely ignore, and it's no question that they really basically ignore the pre-July 9 activity. You do not have to be ignorant.
You say ignore in the sense that they didn't talk about it at all?
Virtually did not talk about
virtually,
it at all.
But they talked about it some, right?
It was as though, yes, there was a date prior to July the 9th, but it was, or dates, several months of activity prior to July 9, but gave it no credence whatsoever. Despite the fact that the employees with whom the management spoke on July the 9th had evidently expressed themselves as being against the union, wanting to get rid of the union, having various ways of saying that, the administrative law judge and the board both gave that, I say virtually ignored it. It was little more than lip service that there was some of that activity. I think that this court can easily look at the facts and conclude that there is not substantial evidence on the record as a whole that disaffection was created by the employer, because it occurred, and in fact the record has evidence that...
Well, if there's pre-existing disaffection, does it absolve the management of any actions that they take after that? I mean,
certainly it begins the story in our view, because we believe that the administrative law judge began reading this book on chapter 10 and ignored the first chapters of how those employees got to the point of July 9 and why the employer felt that it had an obligation, as it had said to those...
Instigate a decertification petition? Or?
No, it had an obligation to respond to employees who had said, how do we get rid of the union? How do we do this? What's the process? And the employer at first said, it's not the time, we can't respond to it, have any details, we don't ourselves understand it. And then at the point where the company was preparing for collective bargaining negotiations, those issues of those employees' disaffection was presented, and the employer then had a right to respond to it. So we begin in a climate, in our view, where disaffection arose prior to the July 9 week. And that's an extremely important part. After the July, then July 9 comes along, and in the conversations with those individuals who had asked, how do we do what we're, how do we accomplish getting rid of the union, the employer came forward and said, you can sign it, you can create a petition, here's what the petition can say. Certainly that activity, Bridgestone, Firestone, the board in Bridgestone Firestone did observed a management official doing much, much more, in fact, dictating the language. And when the individual couldn't understand exactly what the words were supposed to be, the company gave the individual a sample a decertification petition from another location. So our activity at Colony was far less than that activity.
The second part. It's the case that the board has substantial evidence in support of its conclusion that the employer unlawfully participated or assisted in decertification.
I missed the first part of what you'd said, Your Honor.
Was there sufficient evidence to sustain the board's conclusion that the company unlawfully participated in or assisted in decertification? Grant that as a premise. The board seems to take the view that once that's the case, we're not interested in causal connection between the illegality and the actual result. In other words, there seems to be no equivalent, for example, of right line in this context. So, I mean, isn't that a huge problem for you?
The board basically should have conceded, in our view, that disaffection was present in a pristine environment.
Yeah,
we didn't have
it. The board's doctrine, as I understand it, that's not of interest.
Well,
and one false move and we drill you.
That becomes a per se application. That if you've done anything, that
that's the board's rule.
And that ignores the master slack causation.
It doesn't ignore it. They distinguish it. The board distinguishes it as recently as an opinion, the SFO opinion, which I think was issued this last July. They distinguish master slack and Hearst as two different situations and adopt the per se, not adopt it, I mean, they just say that, you know, we follow a per se rule. If the employer is in the middle of soliciting and helping the employees and sign the petition and so on and so forth, we don't care how many, we don't care whether a majority of the employees didn't know about it. We don't care how many were affected. That's the end of story.
No, there's no question that SFO certainly has taken that theory that you're describing, in our view, far beyond where these facts arose, and the board in this case issued a determination. SFO and what that case may mean does not control what this court does with respect to the facts of this case. SFO, of course, was, as you indicated, was a decision of a matter of a couple of months ago, I think it something of that nature. But that's not argued here. The board certainly appears to be moving to a absolute per se. If management had involvement in
it is argued here. The board on about page 40-something, 41, 42 of the brief, somewhere around in there, says that it's irrelevant that some employees may not have known about the activities of the employer, because it's irrelevant because we don't require causation in this type of a situation. And that's how the board interpreted Hertz, and that's how SFO interpreted Hertz. So I come back to Judge Williams' question, how do you overcome that?
Well, certainly Hearst has not been cited by this court, I don't believe, with approval. I don't believe this court has cited, has relied on Hearst. The SFO, of course, wasn't in existence. As far as the...
Well, there is an opinion by our former colleague, Judge Wald, that comes awfully close to adopting or to embracing the board's rule, which has been in effect for quite some time.
Well, I think if you look at, for example, Cater Air, where this
That's
court
the case I was thinking.
Yeah, Cater Air, I believe, if you look at Cater Air and you talk about the fact situation there, there were about 750 employees in a bargaining unit. There, the employer actively solicited scores of people signing on petitions. And there the court said, the administrative law judge said it, the court approved it, and I'm sorry, the board approved it, and then the court observed that there the knowledge of the employer's involvement in actively, very aggressively obtaining the signed petitions was known by everyone. Very different from the situation here where there is a contact by the employer with, for example, Mr. McGinnis. Mr. McGinnis then, with the chart in hand, a chart which the administrative law judge concluded was per se unlawful, which the board backs off of, but really never eliminates the difficulties raised by the administrative law judge's significant reliance on the chart. And in that situation, you have a single situation. The employer is speaking to Mr. McGinnis. Mr. McGinnis then goes out and obtains signature on his petition of several individuals. Those other individuals have absolutely no knowledge of what is alleged to have been an unlawful conversation between the company and Mr. McGinnis. In Cater Air, that's not the case. There is a conclusion by the administrative law judge, the board, and accepted by this court that everyone had to be aware that the employer was up to his elbows and perhaps more in obtaining signatures. So that's a very different case, and Cater Air does not support Hearst. Cater Air could have adopted the Hearst absolute situation, but Cater Air goes into much greater detail to find that there was knowledge by the employees of the employer's actions and that there was a causation, a master slack development there, so that the employer had in fact created the disaffection and had participated in obtaining those signatures. I think I'm into my rebuttal time.
Thank you. We'll hear from the lawyer for the board.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, David Side for the Labor Board. I want to initially address the company's characterization of what occurred here and the substantial evidence that supports the board's findings. At the company meeting that it held on July 9th...
Can you tell me what the rule is? What's the rule? The union can talk to the employees and say, don't sign a petition to decertify us, because we're really good guys and we're really going to help you out, and you know we're going to bargain at the next. But the law is not that. Tell me what the law is. Can the employer then say, "Hey, you should really sign a petition because this union is really not looking out for you"?
Your Honor, in a decertification situation, it's up to the employees to exercise their free choice. The employer can give some basic information if asked, or in a situation, maybe in a meeting, to just generally let them know that they're in a situation where the contract is about to expire, but it cannot actively participate. It cannot actively do what it did here, where it has employees go out and solicit for them. And the suggestion that somehow there was some ample evidence of disaffection prior to July 9th.
But let me back up to Judge Randolph's question. What do you mean by actively participate? He gave you an example. Is that actively participating?
Yes, Your Honor. The employer cannot engage in conduct that would interfere with the employee's free choice, and it cannot.
His hypothetical. Is that permissible or impermissible under the board's rule?
Your Honor, this is not an election campaign. This is not a decertification election. This is not an initial election.
Yeah, we know this, that.
You're saying that the employer's, I guess it's 8C, rights don't exist within the certification context?
Your Honor, the employer has the right to inform employees of what the employees can do. It has the right, as in some cases where it might even propose language. At that point, it is up to the employees to decide what they do or they don't want to do.
My question was, can the employer say, hey, you talked to us in the past about how the union was really you didn't like the union and wanted to get rid of them and so on and so forth, and we think you're right, and we agree with you, and here's how you do it. And what you ought to do is go out and sign a petition and get your fellow employees to do it. Is that a violation of is that an unfair labor practice? That's my question.
Your Honor, objectively, again, the bottom line question is, objectively, has the employer engaged in conduct that would interfere with the employee's rights and objectively have a tendency to coerce them? And if it's simply providing information, the answer would be no. That's not what the company did here. The company didn't simply express a position.
See, because we have a line of cases, and I'm not really sure how you reconcile all these, but XL Atmos is one of them that says, look, the employer can advocate, the employer can cajole, the employer can do this and that, so long as the employer doesn't threaten reprisal and doesn't promise benefits.
Your Honor, in the XL Atmos case, where this court did reverse the board decision, there was one isolated speech to the employees where the employer simply notified the employees of what their rights were under the act.
It was to every employee, as I recall. And the employer arranged for all the employees to come listen to the employer talk about the subject, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But that's not what happened here.
I understand that.
And I do want to draw a very important distinction. There is no evidence of any mass disaffection prior to July 9th. At the meeting, the company decided that it wanted to get the union decertified. It believed that there were three employees that opposed the union. It immediately met with two of those employees. In the case of McGinnis, it held three meetings with him in order to persuade him to sign a decertification petition, to persuade him to get others to sign. It then directed him on what to say, and it unleashed him throughout the plant to go and collect signatures. In the case of Mr. Prizer, the company interrogated him. It persuaded him to go out and collect signatures, and then it essentially accompanied him as he collected signatures.
The union could have done that with McGinnis, right? The union could have met with him three times, four times, five times. Would that have been an unfair labor practice, saying to persuade him not to sign a petition?
Your Honor, the employer cannot engage in conduct that is interfering with the free choice or objectively of a tendency to coerce. And when
what about
the employer...
See, I understand the idea, maybe the idea is that it's, well, this is a different situation because the employer has power over the individuals, over the employees, in the sense that the employer can grant wages and benefits or not do that and so on and so forth. So every time the employer talks to the employee, there's that implied threat of or promise of benefits.
Correct, Your Honor. That would be,
theory?
Yes, that would
I'm
be.
I'm just trying to find out what the law is. That's
right. That would be, as set forth, I believe, in the Gissel Supreme Court case, that the employees are in the tendency of a situation where they're beholden to their employer.
But Gissel was an authorization card case you're talking about.
That's correct.
Yeah. And I thought you were drawing a distinction between, but it wasn't an election, it was a good faith doubt case, but between that situation and decertification.
The basic premise that the situation where an employee is going to be in a different position as to what an employer is telling it might be a little different than what a union might be saying. But I'm not aware of any situations that the board has faced where a union has been alleged to have engaged in any improper conduct during a decertification effort. I'm simply not aware of it.
That's because the union can do anything it wants.
Your Honor, I couldn't say a union would do anything at once. Certainly there are situations in an election campaign where a union's activity can be improper.
Well, if they threaten somebody with physical harm or something. Let me give you a hypothetical that troubles me. Suppose you have 1,000-person bargaining unit, 1,000 employees, right? And the employer gets one employee off to the side and says, I want you to sign the petition to decertify the union, and if you don't, then I'm going to fire you, right? Clearly an unfair labor practice. But the other 999 employees never learn of this, and they vote overwhelmingly to decertify the union. Would the board in that situation say, that's an unfair labor practice, we're not going to recognize the employee's choice because we have a rule that says it doesn't matter if the other employees don't know?
Your Honor, whether there could be a situation where there's an isolated unfair labor practice, such as in the Bridgestone case, that's something for the board to deal with in a particular case. We are not dealing with isolated actions here. And
the employer says they are isolated actions because they affected 43 out of 69 voted against the union or something like that. And you still had 37, I don't know if I have the numbers right, but 37 that weren't affected at all.
Your Honor, it's a mischaracterization of the impact of the company's actions here, because the board found that McGinnis and Prysner, they would not have gone out and solicited signatures but for the company's unlawful actions. Then when most of these signatures end up getting, and when it sends Mr. McGinnis out to the plant to go talk to everybody on work time, changing his work schedule, on its face, objectively, the company has interfered with the employee's choice, and objectively it is engaged in conduct that would have a tendency.
I'm sorry, why does McGinnis's work schedule have anything to do with objective interference with employee choice? McGinnis's work schedule.
Because, Your Honor,
The
company altered his work schedule so it could meet with him. He was supposed to be working in a far-off location.
Right, right.
It brought him back to the plant so it could meet with him, persuade him to solicit signatures, persuade him to go out and solicit other employees, and then it let him go out throughout the plant to solicit signatures. And there is not a single case that the company can refer to where an employer has solicited employees not just to sign, but solicited employees to go out and collect signatures, where that petition objectively is thereby not tainted. Now, as to the question...
That's partly because of the board's rule, right?
Well, the question then becomes, is essentially, can there be an affirmative defense to that? Can an employer...
You just use the language of taint, which suggests that there's a causation requirement. I'd like you to go back to Judge Randolph's hypothetical and answer it. I mean, and we understand it's not the case before us, but we use hypotheticals to get a better understanding of what the law is. So under Judge Randolph's hypothetical, is that impermissible? Can the company engage in that sort of activity or not?
Your Honor, in a situation where there might be one...
Right, that was the example.
Right, one statement toward one employee in a 1,000-person unit.
Right.
The board, as it does on a case-by-case basis, would have to consider it, and there could be a situation such as the Bridgestone case.
What's the standard the board would use?
The standard that the board would use very simply would be is, has the employer objectively interfered with the free choice of its employees, and has it objectively engaged in conduct that would...
So yes or no, what's the answer?
The answer is it would depend on the particular facts of the case. But there could be a situation, again, there is the Bridgestone case that I know the company refers to, where
Have to be a showing of taint that somehow the entire process was infected by the company's conduct.
Your Honor,
you've used that language, and that's in your briefs as well. That suggests a causation, finding a causation.
To say the entire process is enough for the board to show that the process was tainted. It's enough to show that once the employer is...
That happens with one employee out of 1,000 who has been, let's say, improperly influenced.
But, Your Honor, it would...
Regardless of whether...
Whether they tell another about it.
Impact.
Your Honor, if that employee is going out and soliciting other employees...
What if they're not, though? The hypothetical was that it was not. It was just one employee, and other 999 didn't know about it.
Well, Your Honor, again, that could be a situation, such as the Bridgestone case, where there was evidence of one employee being interrogated about a month before a decertification petition, and the board in that case found that there was not sufficient evidence to have tainted the subsequent petition.
And you say in your brief, it's on page 43 at the bottom that it's irrelevant whether other employees knew of the, quote, unlawful action.
That's correct, Your Honor, in the sense that when the company persuades, and again, it's not just a sign, but persuades him to solicit other employees, when the company persuades Prizer to go out and solicit other employees, those other employees don't need to know that the company has acted unlawfully to them in order to have Prizer and McGinnis go solicit.
The presumption is it infects or taints the entire. You know, that is, I must say that there is some suggestion of that in the Caterer opinion.
Correct, Your Honor. In that case, Your Honor, it was about a 428-person unit. I believe that there were only 7 employees who are actually directly, that the company directly acted toward.
And has any court of appeals approved, adopted, or endorsed this theory, the Hearst per se rule, or SFO type per se rule? Any circuit?
Right. Well, Your Honor, the SFO Goodnight case is actually pending before this court. The Fourth Circuit.
The SFO case is pending before this
yes,
court?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And when was it argued?
It actually is about to be briefed, is my understanding.
Oh.
And I will point out the Fourth Circuit in a case called Narakot, although it was cited by the intervener, though I will note to this court that it was a 2-member board decision, but the Fourth Circuit in Narakot did specifically address the distinction between and did address Hearst and why it is essentially a per se violation.
Do you have the citation?
The citation is in the intervener's brief. I apologize.
Okay.
It is in the intervener's brief.
Okay.
And I couldn't get it. I believe I do have it over at the table.
Yeah, that's fine. I can get it.
But I would emphasize that what is really being addressed in that case is not so much the evidence that the board needs to show to establish substantial evidence that the employer has tainted the petition. It's really a question of whether or not the employer can come back with any type of rebuttal evidence.
Right.
And that's what SFO Goodnight forecloses. But that's not an issue here. The company has never claimed that it can actually, that people either testified at the hearing, that they didn't know about what went on, and that they had no knowledge of some of the other unfair labor practices, which include various promises, and even telling an employee that the company was trying to get rid of the union. The company has never presented that evidence and has never tried to say that it was somehow foreclosed from coming up with rebuttal evidence. What it's trying to argue is that the board, once it shows affirmatively that a company has directly participated in the decertification process, that is somehow insufficient, and that is simply contrary to the law.
I have one other question before you sit down on the question of bargaining order. Yeah, is the language that the board used in this case becoming boilerplate? I don't know that it fits the facts of this case. It's kind of, you know, you could put that at the end of every single case in which the board issues a bargaining order.
All right, excuse me, my time is up, but I presume I have the opportunity to answer the question. I can't speak for the board as to whether it's been using the language that it's been using.
Have you run into this language before in other cases?
Your Honor, I can't speak to other cases.
You don't know?
I would, as this court is aware, this is not an issue that's before this court in this case, given that the company never filed exceptions to the bargaining order itself. But as far as how this language compares to other cases, I simply cannot. It
just sounds very familiar to me.
Thank you very much. You have 2 minutes, Mr. Lindsay.
Obviously, a couple of things that have been brought up on this. When Judge Randolph was leading into the questions, he mentioned XL Atmos. XL Atmos is a situation where, without any evidence of disaffection, the employer stands up in front of a group of the entire group of employees and discusses decertification procedures. And shortly thereafter, grants a $100 Christmas bonus to employees.
Unprecedented.
That's the language of the court. The situation here is we had information with respect to two or three employees specifically. There is not evidence, we understand, that everybody in the voting unit, in the bargaining unit, was disaffected. Rather than XL Atmos, where you go to everybody and there is no evidence of anything, no evidence of disaffection whatsoever, rather than in that context, we go to the two or three individuals who had expressed something. Whether they go beyond that or not, we don't know. Judge Randall posed the situation of if the employer had said to Mr. McGinnis, for example, you go get a petition. You go get everybody signed up. The company here didn't do that. The company went back to him and said, if you got that interest, if you're still interested in proceeding it, then here's what you can do. What you do is up to you. May I continue?
You have 20 seconds.
All right. The isolated Bridgestone Firestone situation was four-person unit. One person is the direct subject of an unfair labor practice. The other three don't know about that activity, and there is very strong information that or evidence that the employer there had that conversation.
Thank you. We have your argument.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Court's adjourned.